Illinois hog farms have boomed in recent years. The state is now the fourth largest seller of pigs. But a Chicago Tribune investigation found weak rules, understaffed enforcement, and environmental damage. Hog farmers say, sure, there are some bad apples, but overall they say their farms are humane, clean, and efficient, and help put affordable pork on our tables. Phil Borgic talked with the Tribune.
The animal itself is telling us that this is the environment that I like. You know, we have less injury with our employees, and through the years, this is what I have found to be the best for the animals.
Problems in the pork industry, we'll hear from Borgic and the reporters behind the investigation. Plus, Blagojevich is resentenced, money's pouring into state and local races, and the Illinois Press Association draws a line between news and political propaganda. We've got our weekly preview of Illinois politics. I'm Scott Cameron. That's all coming up today on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. 4 years ago, a farmer in Iroquois County found a nearby creek looked like ink. He said dead fish lay all over the place. The stench, he said, was awful. State officials said a waste spill from a hog farm polluted more than 20 miles of Beaver Creek, killing more than 150,000 fish and mussels. Illinois' growing hog farm industry helps put cheap pork on our plates, but an investigation by the Chicago Tribune shows it comes at a cost to the environment, to nearby residents, and to the animals themselves. Tribune reporters David Jackson and Gary Marks led that investigation. They'll join us here in just a minute. We'll also hear from those in the hog business who say that for the most part, they're doing things right and doing a service to the state. As I mentioned, we'll talk with the reporters David Jackson and Gary Marks here in just a minute from Chicago. First, though, I want to bring in Phil Borgic. He's a hog farmer in Montgomery County, just south of Springfield. Joins us now on the line from there. Phil, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Yes, good morning.
So I know a lot of people, including myself, you know, really won't have a good idea of what we mean by a modern hog farm. Can you kind of give us a 30-second radio tour, I guess? If I'm on your farm, what am I going to see?
I'm a third-generation pig farmer. I actually started my career with outside production, where my animals were exposed to frostbite and warm weather. And today, through this, my 40-year career,
oh, Phil, you still there? All right, it sounds like we lost Phil. We'll try to get Phil back up on the line here in just a minute. Also making the connection to the Tribune Tower to reach the reporters themselves at WGN Radio. The investigation itself was a long one, ran course of last week, and is still going on, called The Price of Pork, ran in the Chicago Tribune. It talked about some of the smells that can come off of hog farms. One neighbor of a farmer of a big hog farm talked about sort of the experience of his property values declining, a number of other issues that they ran into. Right now I'm getting a signal here. Phil, are you back on the line, Phil?
Yes, I am.
All right, Phil, sorry about that. Sometimes phone lines can be tricky.
Yes, I am.
Across the state. So you're saying you were a third-generation farmer and kind of giving us a little bit of a tour here on your farm.
Yes, and just to summarize it, you know, I started with outside production. And then through the years, in the last 40 years, and we've modernized our facility to better take care of our animals, take care of the environment, and our pig professionals.
In terms of, you know, can you give us a sense of the scope? So if I'm looking at on your property, on your farm, you know, what do the facilities look like?
They are white facilities, white buildings. Under roof, and when you drive by, you would not be able to see our animals because we have them in environmentally controlled facilities to keep them, you know, cool in this hot weather we've just experienced, mm-hmm. and then also warm in the winter.
Okay, so and one of the things that you talked about specifically in the reporting here in the Tribune was your breeding operation. And this is something that there's some contention around. You know, the pregnant pigs on your and other farms, they spend their time in tightly confined areas, you know, what are called gestation crates. There are some opponents, you know, I was reading about here that have compared them to coffins, say that they're, you know, inhumane. But you say pigs actually prefer them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, with my experience of raising pigs outside and moving them inside, then we strive every day to figure out how they to make them more comfortable and perform better. Today, as people come to the farm, as I did the reporters from Chicago Tribune, is how do you measure animal care, animal welfare, and the response is because they can't talk, is performance, and in how they're able to move throughout the day and raise their pigs. And by using individual maternity pens, then each animal is protected from the neighbor. When we have them in groups, we always have a boss. And by having them in individual maternity pens, then each one of them has their own space. We're able to feed each one of them to their body condition so they don't get too fat or too thin. And we're also able then to administer individual treatments if necessary. But by putting them in maternity pens, then we have found that we have much less mortality and in much less of treatments.
And how do you respond? You know, they quoted Phil Shapiro from the Humane Society of the United States saying it's hard to imagine a more miserable existence in these crates. I mean, it sounds like it enables more protection, regulation of feeding and avoiding of some of the social problems and stealing of food and whatnot that you might run into. But, I mean, where does that disconnect come from, do you think? Why is there – how do you respond, I guess, to that idea that it's sort of a miserable existence?
Well, as the person in charge of taking care of my animals – I have to have facts and let the pig tell me what actually works for them. And again, that goes back to observation, being with them every day, being able to measure their performance as a measurement of care and well-being. And so that's what I've spent my 40-year career doing. And those points to different methods of housing, and we don't all have to have the same method. But today I've chosen the individual maternity pens.
And some companies and shoppers have said that they plan to stop buying pork from breeders who use the pens and the crates like that. Do you feel any pressure to change? Do you see a shift coming?
We continue to monitor our customer base. And always looking for ways to improve our production every day. And so we will continue to monitor the situation as it moves forward.
All right. And Phil, you know, again, it's coming at this from the perspective of somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience on hog farms and whatnot, what do you want people to know about hog farms, about what you do?
Well, I really want to commend the Chicago Tribune reporters and that staff. They've done from my end. We've spent 30 hours together on learning the pork producer industry. I've really enjoyed their presence. But what came out in the articles is the one percenters, contracting was poor. Well, they've talked to the one percenters. They did not look at the industry as a whole. And what I want the people to understand is that our goal of taking care of our animals today and in the future and providing a safe, wholesome product then for our consumer.
Okay. And by the 1%, you mean sort of the few, the bad apples, the problems that crop up?
Every industry has it. Yeah, every industry has a bad apple, has a problem. And we continue to get better. In the 60s and 70s, when I started, our manure handling program at that time was the next big rain. Well, today then, we capture that valuable resource of the pig manure to be able to put back on our corn and soybean crop to raise next year's crop then to feed the pigs and then feed other components of our industry. And before, we just weren't able to do that.
All right. Well, Phil Borgic, thank you very much. I appreciate sort of the taking us inside the hog farm there and giving a bit of a picture of overview of the industry there. Thank you for the time and the flexibility this morning as well.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care. In a few minutes, we will also talk with Jennifer Terry, of the Executive Director of the Illinois Pork Producers Association. But first, let's go ahead now and bring, I think we've made that connection with Chicago Tribune reporter David Jackson there in the Tribune Tower. David, welcome to the 21st. I appreciate you joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, you know, I opened up the program a little bit, reading from one of your articles talking about Beaver Creek, you know, and we heard Phil there talk about kind of, you know, the small proportion of people who do get it wrong or do something wrong here. But, you know, one of the things that did go wrong was Beaver Creek, you know, more than 100,000 fish and mussels dead, over 20 miles of creek there. I mean, what that's a creek in east central Illinois here. You know, what happened there that caused that kind of damage?
Well, it's still being disputed. The hog confinement called Hopkins Farms, Hopkins Ridge Farms, is disputing that they're responsible. But essentially, in the summer of 2012, a massive fish kill emerged in that stream. And the as you point out, the fish died for roughly 20 miles, and it was 148,000 fish and about 17,000 mussels. And nearby farmers and ultimately conservation officials rushed to the scene, and as they always do in those instances, they kind of walk back the spill and determine the source, and they determined that Hopkins Ridge, according to state officials, had been pumping manure wastewater onto a field as fertilizer and had let that go on way too long for days, and until the waste started spilling off the earth and into a nearby ditch that took it into the stream. And we tried to look at every instance in Illinois where that had happened during a 10-year period. We got records from the State Department of Natural Resources and from the EPA and other agencies. And we found that over that 10-year period, the swine facilities accounted for nearly half of the roughly million fish killed in Illinois waterways, as determined by government agencies during that 10 years, and accounted for the lion's share of the miles of streams and creeks and rivers impaired.
And that 10 years was the most recent 10 years
available. Yeah, Yeah, it was the most recent 10 years. It takes sometimes a year or two after these events for all the reports to be compiled and put mm-hmm. together. So we took basically 2005 through 2014 and analyzed all those events.
And you said with there in Beaver Creek that it was disputed. What's the dispute there?
Well, the facility is simply, as happens in many of these cases, denied responsibility, and so the state attorney general has taken them to court, and they're facing a pending court suit that's going on right now. The attorney general is trying to collect from Hopkins Ridge the reimbursement for the restocking of the fish, as well as very, very significant penalties for environmental pollution.
Okay. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about kind of the regulations and the penalties and some other things that you've written about in this series here. But to step back for a minute here first, can you kind of describe the overview, the process in layman's terms, you know, across the state? How many hogs are we talking about? How much waste? How are things stored? Like, what do people need to understand as a baseline before we start getting into these details?
Sure. Illinois markets about 12 million hogs a year, and more than 90% of them are raised for their lives, which is usually about a 5-month period, in these large confinement facilities. They hold thousands of pigs and, as you can imagine, produce hundreds of thousands or sometimes millions of gallons of waste. You talked to Phil Borjak, one of the very, very gracious hog raisers who welcomed us into his facility and taught us about his part of the work. Phil talked about something that's absolutely part of the model, which is that under ideal circumstances, what's supposed to happen is those waste is supposed to be stored and then transmitted, usually through hoses and pipes and drag lines, to adjoining cropland where it's carefully injected into the ground to be used as fertilizer.
Sort of a recycling system that's built in.
Yeah, it's a perfect virtuous circle, because then you're raising corn and beans with that really powerful fertilizer, and obviously feeding it back to the pigs, creating what's sort of known as a virtuous cycle. Mm-hmm. But when you have that much waste, things can and have and do break down. And so we found that the lagoons and tanks where the waste is stored can crumble and overflow. There can be ruptures in the pipes and hoses and drag lines that carry the stuff out to the fields. And in a few tragic cases that we documented, there are instances where operators basically willfully dump because they didn't have anything else that they knew to do with the amount of waste that they had.
Hmm. And how, I mean, that kind of raises a question, too. How has the industry in Illinois changed over the years here in terms of both overall size but also in terms of the operations on the farms themselves?
It's the size and the number of these operations has really grown dramatically in Illinois over the last 20 years. And so they're getting bigger, and there are more of them. And I think that's the big trend.
All right, so bigger, more with each one, more of this waste that you're talking about, and then, you know, whatever the small percentage is of these kind of bad apples that we heard Phil Borgic talk about earlier, it can lead to some issues, some problems. We'll talk more here in a few minutes about some of the regulations, some of the laws, some of the issues around permitting and the creation of these facilities here in just a moment. We're talking with Chicago Tribune reporter David Jackson. The series of articles here is called The Price of Pork, taking a look at some of the questions that have arisen across the state as the pork industry has grown. We'll also talk in just a minute with the executive director of the Illinois Pork Producers Association and hear more about the industry perspective on what is going on right now in Illinois. Stay with us. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. We are talking about the Illinois pork industry, about some of the issues that are highlighted in a recent Chicago Tribune investigation. Here we've got on the line with us from Chicago, David Jackson, one of the Tribune reporters behind that series. And Dave, we talked a little bit earlier and got kind of a tour behind one hog farm. You kind of laid out the overall size and scope of what's been happening in Illinois. Let's dig in now on some of these details and things. You know, the first story of this series told of a farmer whose neighbor expanded into a large hog operation. He described, you know, terrible smells, his property values plummeted and whatnot. What kinds of regulations are in place that govern where large hog farms can operate?
Well, Scott, we found that citizens don't really have a lot of recourse about this. It was one of the surprising parts of this investigation and why we led with that story. We sort of expected that Animal rights groups like PETA and environmental activists would be the main opponents of these facilities. But when we got around rural counties and started knocking on doors and talking to folks, we quickly found that a lot of the pushback and a lot of the concerns about these facilities came from longstanding farm families and rural community residents who basically don't have a lot of rights if the pork industry wants to build one of these massive facilities right next door. And the issue isn't simply smells, although the smells are intense or can be intense and very annoying, but that all of that swine waste as it decomposes, as it's stored over the months at the facility produces ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. And those gases, which can be really cause respiratory problems, mix with particles that are emitted by the facilities like animal dander and fecal dust and things like that.
Yeah, you talked to this particular farmer's wife had talked about having to stay indoors and having some of the respiratory issues that you would refer to there. You know, I wonder, I mean, you mentioned that there was really no recourse for residents in these areas and neighbors and whatnot. I mean, if I'm going to build, say, a wind farm or a new electrical facility or something like that, there is a permitting process. There are public hearings. There are ways to sort of get involved in the process. Is that different in this case?
It is, Scott. It's starkly different. In The case of wind farms, for example, that you brought up, there's local control at the county level, and the permitting decisions really involve a lot of input from local residents. With the livestock confinements, the way the laws are written in Illinois is that if a facility has more than 2,500 pigs and 75 nearby residents sign a petition in the county, they can get a hearing at the county level over the permitting of that facility. But, Scott, the hearing that's held is completely non-binding. It's merely a recommendation to the State Agriculture Department, which is going to decide on issuing the permit. And we found there's numerous instances where counties have a hearing and say, no, we don't want this, but the decision then goes to the Agriculture Department. And again, under Illinois law, the Agriculture Department does not have the power to deny a permit. They can merely send one back for further questions. And we looked at data going back to 1996, and we found that more than 80% of the applications that were filed ended up being built.
Well, that's a significant number there. Looking then, sort of once a facility is built, you know, one of the issues that you raised in the reporting was staffing levels among state inspectors. So how are these regulations enforced and by who?
Well, with the environmental part of it, the EPA does not get involved in the permitting until after the facility is up and running. And we looked at EPA data, again, going back many years, and we found that the number of inspections had dropped significantly. Scott, as you and your listeners well know, the EPA and the Ag Department, these are agencies that have really faced staff and funding cuts given Illinois' budget crisis. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise there. We found that the EPA did not know even the locations of more than half of the 500 largest facilities. So these are really big, mega facilities.
Don't know or would or wouldn't reveal the information?
Do not know.
They don't know.
Do not know. This is the EPA. The State Agriculture Department does know the location of many of the largest facilities, not all, but many, but they will not make that information available, or they don't seem to be cooperating with the EPA, which is trying belatedly to build an inventory of these operations.
Mm-hmm. And you detailed with some of those budget cuts and whatnot that, you know, some of the investigations that did happen, as I read through the series of articles, you know, there were a couple of phone calls maybe, and somebody would say, no, we're not doing that here, and then the investigation would be closed, or a call to a veterinarian who travels there once a month, and they would say, no, I haven't seen that, the investigation would be closed. I wonder, how does Illinois, I mean, with some of the things you're talking about here, with both the permitting and sort of the oversight, the regulation once a facility is up and running, how does Illinois compare to other states in terms of these regulations?
Sure. If you look, Scott, at the other big pork-producing states, just go to that very sort of basic question, does the state EPA know where the facilities are? And is the public allowed to know that? If you go to the other big pork-producing states, Iowa, North Carolina, Minnesota, and many of the other top 10 pork states in America, certainly for the top three, Illinois is the fourth, but for the top three, any citizen can go online, for example, on the Iowa or North Carolina or Minnesota department websites and look up all the addresses of all the facilities. Again, here in Illinois, the state EPA does not know the addresses it knows the addresses of fewer than half of the largest facilities. And again, the Agriculture Department knows many more, but it will not make them public.
It won't make them public. Interesting. All right. We're talking with David Jackson of the Chicago Tribune. This series of articles called, under the headline, The Price of Pork, looking at an investigation into the pork industry in Illinois. We talked earlier with hog farmer Phil Borgic in Montgomery County, south of Springfield here in Illinois. On the line with us now is Jennifer Tyree. She's executive director of the Illinois Pork Producers Association. And Jennifer, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today.
And we heard from Phil, you know, and from others that, you know, sure, in any industry there are going to be some bad apples. You know, Phil referred to it as the 1%, but that doesn't really paint a complete picture of pork producers in Illinois. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. the thing that I want to make sure to emphasize is that these pig farmers, they work in those barns. They live on these farms. Their children are raised on these farms. And so to give that impression that they are confinements that are not part of a family organization is really something that we want to make sure that your listeners understand.
So that they're family operations, you're saying, it sounds like that they care for the animals that are there and are trying to do their best. I think we heard a similar thing from Phil. You know, in terms of some of the issues and some of the problems that have come up, I mean, are there some best practices on farms or things, are there any changes, you think, in response to what some of these issues, even if they are just a small number of them, that need to happen within the industry, do you think?
Well, absolutely. We, as an industry, are always continuing to evolve and to change and to learn more about how we can do things better. Over the last 50 years, we have reduced our water usage by 41%. We've reduced our land usage by 78% and our overall carbon footprint by 35%. And so, yes, there is always things that we can be doing better, and that's really why I am so proud to support these pig farmers, is because they're never resistant to change. They understand that it's an ever-changing industry.
And Phil talked a little bit about, some of the contract farmers, and then sometimes they get a bad name for it. That type of a shift from sort of a small scale farm to a large scale operation like that, where you're working for a firm that may be far away and increasing the scale or whatnot, but the responsibility really lies in terms of regulations and meeting requirements on the local farmers. He said that he felt like that kind of got a bad name in some sense. I mean, how has that changed the way that hog farms operate right now in Illinois, and how has that scale changed the requirement and the needs to meet some of these regulations?
Well, for instance, you take Phil, who is a family-owned farm, and he has 14 grower partners who are also family-based farms. Since I've been on board here with the Illinois Pork Producers, we've hosted several open houses in different communities across the state, several of them being Phil Borgick's grower partners, and it is not uncommon to see children on the hips of the mothers or knee-high, because these are the next generation that are coming into the pork industry, and they may not otherwise have an opportunity to stay on the farm if not for building that barn on their farm. They may already have a row crop part of the farm, and by adding this barn, it's allowing these families and these children to stay and continue to work and be a part of that family farm.
And then for those small groups, what should there be, new legislation, do you think? What sort of changes would you see? Because any industry, I mean, you speak for across a broad industry here in Illinois. I would imagine, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, that as somebody who works in this industry, that you want an industry that is effective and working cleanly pretty much across the board. Do you see any sort of, is there a specific legislation or some way of creating something to help push more people in the direction of what you're describing there? Because, like Phil said, there are some bad apples there. So what is the next step to help to find those bad apples, pick them out, and clean up the process?
Sure. Well, let me tell you what has happened. With the Livestock Management Facilities Act, it's been on the books since 1996, and it's seen three different amendments. But with that, we have also continued to learn from what our producers are hearing from their communities. But not only that, but with our environmental side, there were new stronger rules put into effect in 2014 that actually are in line with our federal guidelines. And so a lot of the information in the Tribune stories, as David Jackson mentioned, were from 10 years ago, and our industry continues to do better with these new, stronger guidelines that have been put forth with the federal matching laws. That helps our producers have a better understanding of what's necessary. We don't want to pollute any of the waters. Our families live on these farms and drink that water. It is a responsibility for us as pig farmers to make sure that we are offering a safe product and that we are taking care of the land for our future generations. So those stronger federal regulations help us to do that. with the comments about animal welfare. None of our industry would ever condone any sort of animal welfare. And this is something that I do understand that the Department of Agriculture may be understaffed with their 6 inspectors, but talking to the Illinois State Veterinarian, Mark Ernst, he indicated to me that there had not been any swine-related allegations that were not investigated over a 10-year period. So yes, all of our state agencies are understaffed, and that is a shame. However, any of our swine-related animal abuse issues have not gone unnoticed and taken care of in a timely fashion by the Illinois Department of Agriculture.
Jennifer Tyree, Executive Director of the Illinois Pork Producers Association. David Jackson, you know, there's a phrase, and just keeping with this theme here, that seemed to pop up frequently in your stories from state officials, from residents, from some of the farmers. It was legislative fix. You know, are there examples in other states of some sort of, you know, legislative fix that would change the way the pork industry is operated and regulated in Illinois?
Well, I really commend you, Scott, for putting together this mosaic of voices, and I would just urge your listeners to check out the stories and articles and videos for themselves in terms of some of the things that have been raised and make up their own minds.
Mm-hmm.
We covered a huge amount of topics, from animal welfare to environment to the permitting and siting to the contract farming and economics.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the workers or the animal, some of those. So yeah, it's a massive, massive article.
It's a massive, it's sprawling. So no, there's not a silver bullet, but I do think that we heard again and again from impacted farming families, from neighbors, and many of whom had legal training or had been judges and so forth, that the Livestock Facilities Management Act was put in place with best intentions as a compromise 20 years ago, but the industry has really expanded greatly since then, and many people told us that it's time to revisit the way the laws are written in Illinois that protect waterways and rural communities.
And, we heard a similar thing, I think it was the final article, Senator Dick Durbin made some similar comments about more oversight and things. Are there models out there, though? I mean, are there examples, Iowa, others that are, among the top? I think Illinois is number 4 in terms of sales of, products from pigs. Are there models out there that that jumped out at you?
I found best practices around the country in counties and in states, but it's not like it's a moving target in a sense, as all legislation is. And there's always, as you know, Scott, from covering this type of thing over the years, if you fix one thing, it can create another problem somewhere else that you didn't anticipate. Yeah. So I don't think, again, that a journalist like me sits there and says, here's the silver bullet. And because obviously, unlike Phil Borgic, I don't have any life experience doing mm-hmm. this, and I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I'm someone who goes around and uses the tools of journalism to try to look at the world. And I do think at a certain time, when you do find things that are wrong, that's the time for the people with expertise and life experience to step in and see if there's not a better way.
Yeah. Real quick, we've only got about 30 seconds here, but one of the articles talked about, how people know some of the labels that people can look at, and if they're looking for specific information. Can you kind of give a 15-second preview of what sort of information is available in terms of labeling for some of these pork products?
Sure. Well, in the story that had to do with animal welfare, Scott, we looked at what sort of labels are out there in a grocery store having to do with pork that a consumer might encounter.
Yeah.
And we found that there were 5 big ones. And really, frankly, we found that in some cases they're extremely confusing. And
David, I'm
misleading.
Sorry to interrupt, but we'll have to go to the articles for that one. Thank you very much, David
sure.
Jackson, Chicago Tribune. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. Nyla Boodoo is out this week, and we're out of time there, but thanks to Jennifer Tyree, Executive Director of the Illinois Pork Producers Association, also to David Jackson with the Chicago Tribune with us from the Tribune Tower there, the investigative series The Price of Pork that he wrote along with Gary Marks. We have links, more information. He was speaking there at the end about some of the labels, humane pork labels that are available All of that is available through links at our website that will take you over to that articles, the big series that he had talked about there. Now, our weekly look at state politics. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich scheduled to appear virtually in federal court today. Governor Rauner being sued by an anti-abortion group. A new gun sales bill aims to limit the trafficking of guns across state lines. And a question, who decides what's news and what's political propaganda? We'll get into all this here in the next few minutes. On the line from WUIS in Springfield, we have Brian Mackey. Covers state government and politics. On the line from Peoria, Chris Kjærgaard with the Peoria Journal-Star. Brian, Chris, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good morning.
Hey, guys. Former Governor Rod Blagojevich scheduled to appear in federal court today by video link from prison in Colorado. You know, most of us remember the broad outlines of this case. A sitting governor convicted several counts related to trying to trade, sell, barter, whatnot, the U.S. Senate seat that was left open by then-Senator Barack Obama. Serving 14 years in a Colorado prison, but he appealed. Brian, I'll turn to you on this one. Can you remind us why we're talking now about a resentencing?
Yeah, because the appellate court did decide that some of the counts for which he was convicted, which weren't just about selling President Obama's Senate seat when he was elevated from the U.S. Senate to the presidency. There was also attempting to shake down a children's hospital and a horse race track over some things that they wanted done in state law. And so the appellate court, federal appellate court in Chicago, decided that some of the charges should be tossed against the governor. And so the federal government could have opted to retry him on those five. I believe it was 5 out of 17 charges. They decided not to do that for good reason. Frankly, all of the people who had been in the U.S. Attorney's Office when Blagojevich was prosecuted have moved on to other things in life, and they just asked for a resentencing. The governor would like a lower prison term than the 14 years, which a lot of observers have said was pretty harsh for what's effectively a white-collar crime. Hmm. Nobody was killed here. Nobody was maimed or anything like that. But obviously, it was a significant breach of trust, of the people's trust, and the judge gave him a harsh sentence. He's trying to get that lowered.
And we saw, you know, a letter came out. Patty Blagojevich's wife wrote a letter to the judge making the case that the former governor should be allowed to come home early, to be a father to his daughters. The judge is also going to hear, as we mentioned, from Blagojevich himself. You know,
I should say at this point, he already has. Actually, I've been following it on Twitter. This is amazing times we live in. You can't actually get broadcast coverage of federal courts yet, but apparently they are allowing Twitter. So a number
live
of our editorial colleagues are up there. Yeah, very emotional testimonies from the governor's daughters, Amy and Annie, ages, I believe, 13 and 20. I might have their names reversed with the ages there, mm-hmm. but basically saying that we're growing up without our father and we would like him to come home. He does try and keep in touch with them, I guess, through email and calls, but obviously just not the same thing. Blagojevich made his case, and as we speak now on Monday, or I should say Tuesday morning, the prosecutors are making their case and saying that Blagojevich has really, you know, while he has acknowledged quote-unquote mistakes, he's never really taken responsibility for the crimes for which he was convicted.
And that was going to be, you know, one of the things that people were going to be watching for today, is that when Blagojevich does speak, you know, for himself, that not only what he has to say, but how he says it could affect his sentence.
And, you know, and remember, he was always a very sharp campaigner. He won. The people of the state of Illinois elected him twice to be their governor, including the second time around when he was going into some very significant headwinds. There were already allegations and certainly questions about his hiring practices in the administration and things that he had done. But he is a very effective talker, whether a longtime federal judge who's already given him 14 years for that, you know, will be persuaded by that, remains to be seen at this moment.
All right, so one thing to keep an eye on there to find out, will there be a decision today? Will we know today what happens to his sentence?
I would expect so. We may know before the end of the show. I'm keeping an eye on it.
All right, God bless Twitter, I guess. Everything going on. All right, let me turn, you know, and Chris, I'll throw this one at you. You know, yesterday we saw Jason Gonzalez, Chicago Democrat, challenge House Speaker Michael Madigan in the primary. He sued the Speaker. What's that all about?
Well, a big part of his argument is that the Madigan campaign improperly brought into the race his conviction. He had received a pardon from the governor, but also arguing essentially a notion of voter suppression or fraud in that he believes that Speaker Madigan recruited other Hispanic candidates to put on the ballot to help dilute Mr. Gonzalez's turnout or those who voted for Gonzalez in the primary.
To split the vote a little or whatnot.
Right, and that's a time-honored tactic, not only in that district, but in others to try to confuse voters and to try to reduce the turnout for your opponent. We've also seen in the past other candidates who, it's been alleged, have tried to field somebody from the other party, a plant who was put onto the ballot from the other party to try to either drive up fundraising or drive support to them or even to create a straw man argument for themselves and their virtues. So it's politics, as the old saying goes, politics ain't beanbag.
Well, and I mean, some of the mailers and things that we're talking about here and the ads and whatnot that came out, I mean, there were some hard-hitting ads, but these things, the claims, you know, whether it be the defamation or some of the other arguments, these can be tough to prove. I mean, we can't guess at sort of motivation here or whatnot, but I wonder if some of this might be, you know, by getting out there and saying, I am going to file this suit, you know, they are difficult to prove in some cases, but he may be staking a claim in the public and saying that these things aren't true in his mind.
Well, and it certainly brings it up at a convenient time. If this were a crucial and critical issue that one thinks might have affected the outcome of the election, I suppose you would have expected to have seen this suit sooner to the March primary than early August filing going into a fall campaign season where a lot of folks who are against Mike Madigan are going to be expected to tie the speaker to everything they believe is wrong in the state. And certainly there's been some attention attracted by the choice of lawyer in the suit with Tony Parayka, a former Cook County board chairman candidate and an active Republican up in Cook County being the lawyer for the plaintiff here.
Yeah. Well, let's leave
it.
Go ahead,
if I could just jump in on that. Something you said that struck me a little bit was that, you know, we can't speculate on the motives, but that certainly hasn't stopped Speaker Madigan from speculating on the motives. And he noted that the people who supported Gonzalez's campaign, there's a significant overlap in that Venn diagram, if you will, of Governor Rauner's supporters. And we've seen other attempts just to basically divide the speaker's attention, I think. I mean, he is known as a sort of a master of three-dimensional chess of Illinois politics. And, you know, I think that the method here is open as many fronts to get him not thinking about helping his members win re-election and maintain his supermajority in the legislature and, you know, trying to divide his attention a little bit.
And, I mean, that kind of takes us right into some of the money and things that we're seeing flow around the state right now. I mean, a lot of the local races and some of the other, you know, state races and whatnot, there is a significant amount of money flowing. Some of these from Governor Rauner, indirectly in many cases. But, you know, Brian, I mean, just continuing down that path a little bit, I mean, can you talk about some of the other things that we're seeing in terms of the candidates and the financing right now in Illinois elections?
I mean, this is pretty remarkable to see that we're having television ads going up this early, but you know, before the state fair, which is kind of one of the traditional state political markers of really when the fall campaign begins to gear up nationally, it's generally thought as Labor Day. Usually this is kind of a lull period, and we're seeing particularly in southern Illinois, but even in the Chicago area, a very expensive media market, we're seeing television ads already. So I think that, it's worth keeping in mind that on the Republican side this year, which has definitely not been the case in the past, they have essentially a bottomless pool of money in the form of Governor Rauner, who is an extremely, extremely wealthy man who's shown willingness to spend tens of millions of dollars, not only on his own political career, but on those of other Republicans.
And just one other way, this is not sort of your average election year in many ways. You mentioned the state fair there. Chris, you know, kicking off in Springfield here this week, fair's not immune to the state budget problems. Admission rates are higher this year compared to previous years. What's driving that?
Well, if you ask the State Department of Agriculture that very question, they'll say that it tied to a reevaluation of the rates, one, recognizing the budget concerns that the state faces, but also they argue that state fair admission rates had not been reassessed since 2012, so about 4 years, and that they say is part of the reason they've gone ahead, increased the adult admission rate $3 to a flat $10 a head to get in during most days of the state fair. Of course, they also argue that one of the offsets to that is they've changed the rate for children, and now children age 12 and younger are able to get in free. Again, the argument being it's still viable as family entertainment for the course of a day.
Yeah. And did the butter cow sculptor get paid from last year?
The butter cow sculptor, I believe, did get paid from last year. We do have a new butter cow sculptor this year, and certainly there are plenty of other vendors who are still concerned over whether or not they'll receive their payments for work they're doing this year. We have a trophy company in Peoria that had been charged with providing a number of the trophies for winners last year that was very vocal about not receiving their payments last year in a timely fashion.
Yeah, and I mean, I love butter cows. It's kind of a cute thing at the fair, but there was a lot of serious issues there in terms of people not getting paid, you know, from last year, and some lawsuits even that were filed there. So another something else to keep an eye on here is the budget back and forth continues. Chris,
one other point, yeah, on the fair, if I can make it too, that Illinois tends not to discuss very often, though it comes up as an issue each time the fair comes around, is that Illinois continues to support two state fairs. Coming on the heels of the state fair in Springfield will, of course, be the DuQuoin State Fair in deep southern Illinois. And there are questions every year as to whether or not the state ought to condense to one state fair rather than two.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I just think this is part and parcel of what we've seen throughout state government, where things that maybe had been loss leaders in the past are being examined for their cost efficiency. The state fair has never been a big moneymaker, just like the state museum wasn't. Well, now there's an admission fee at the state museum, and we're seeing the admission price going up at the state fair. I think this is just a sort of a hallmark of the change in philosophy that's coming out of Governor Rauner's administration.
Yeah, shoring up some finances. One quick thing here. We've just got a couple of minutes left, but you know, we've been seeing some people around the state have been seeing what appear to be newspapers showing up in their mailboxes around the state. They're not quite newspapers. There's an interesting conversation going on right now with the Illinois Press Association, some others, because some of these papers are seeking recognition by the Illinois Press Association, but they're actually Republican-funded mailers. Can you give a little background on these just relatively briefly, and then what's the discussion going on right now with IPA and some of these groups?
Well, the Illinois Press Association came out early in the week with I don't know whether to call it a release or a ruling that they do not consider to be eligible for membership or to be newspapers. A number of these publications that are being sent around by a group organized, coordinated by Dan Proft, a Republican political operative and sometime radio host up in Chicago in the suburbs. These mailers are going around with very little indication of any sort of journalistic fairness to them.
But with names like Shambana Sun and East Central Reporter, Kankakee Times,
right,
you know, they sound and look like newspapers.
Right. They are designed with a nameplate on the front to appear to be a newspaper, and they contain what appear to be stories with headlines and material, quotes, photos, everything that one tends to expect at first glance from a newspaper. But as you look at them, they are what amount to campaign pieces that are being sent around. It's a regular tactic that's been used elsewhere in Illinois, in the Peoria area. Former Congressman Aaron Shocks, former campaign manager, used to send these around regularly, not just for Shock, but also for other candidates he supported. Bobby Schilling, who ran twice against now Representative Sherry Bustos, had these sent out on his behalf.
But now they're asking for press recognition.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that also depends on your perspective on it. Dan Proft indicated this morning that they had not sought any type of recognition, nor did they wish recognition from the State Press Association.
Hmm. All right, well, we'll have to leave that one there. We got Chris Garagard, political reporter, Peoria Journal Star. Also, Brian Mackey, WUAS, reporter covering state government and politics there right outside the State House. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. This is The 21st.